Fibers Interpretations Committee received a request to clarify the applicability of Fibers 3 by joint operators for the acquisition of interests in joint operations as defined in Fibers 11, and venturers for the acquisition of interest in jointly controlled operations or asset as specified in IS 31 in circumstances in which the activity of the joint operation or the activity of the jointly controlled operations or assets constitute a business as defined in IVS 3. The committee was asked whether the acquirer of such an interest should apply the principles in IVS 3 on the initial recognition of the interest or whether the acquirer should instead account for it as the acquisition of a group of assets. In September 2011, the committee discussed the issue but did not arrive at a conclusion on a view that IFRS 3 is not required to be applied to the particular assets and liabilities of a joint operation in circumstances where the joint operator acquires an interest in a joint operation in which the activity of the joint operation constitutes a business as defined in IFRS 3. Many committee members were opposed to the view that IFRS 3 is required to be applied to such acquisition. In consideration of this view, this paper analyzes options to proceed with the project by assuming that IFRS 3 is not one of the IFRSs applicable to the particular assets and liabilities in terms of paragraph 21 of IFRS 11. Furthermore, the committee directed the staff in the September meeting to analyze whether a premium paid for synergies can be recognized as a separate asset under another standard, for example, IS 38, or whether IFRS 3 could be applied by analogy, and whether further guidance should be developed on this issue. Accordingly, this paper includes first, an analysis of whether a premium paid for synergies can be recognized as a separate asset under IS 38 or another standard. Second, an analysis of whether guidance in IFRSs exists to account for the acquisition of an interest in a joint operation in circumstances in which the activity of the joint operation constitutes a business. And third, an analysis of the options to proceed with this project. First of all, I want to propose to discuss these three issues separately. I think makes it easier to go through that and structure the discussion like that. Are you fine with this proposal, or do you think we should discuss it all at once?
Can you point us to specific paragraphs in the paper, perhaps, that you want to group?
Yes. First of all, I want to address whether a premium paid for synergies can be recognized as a separate asset. We conclude from the guidance in paragraph 12 of IS 38 and the basis for conclusion on IFRS 3 that such a premium cannot be recognized as a separate identifiable asset if these synergies relate to the business and can only be sold, transferred, licensed, rented, or exchanged together with the entire business or combined business. Our outreach to interested parties is still continuing, but we haven't noticed synergies so far that could be recognized as a separate asset under this guidance, and we would be interested to hear from committee members whether they can contribute specific examples. Furthermore, we noted from outreach activities that premiums are mostly paid for synergies that relate to the business or a combination of business because they result from combining the acquirer's activities with that of other joint operators. We understand that it's common for entities to enter into joint arrangements because they expect such synergies. Consequently, we think that premiums paid for synergies on the acquisitions of an interest in a joint operations are in many cases not recognized as separate asset, and further guidance for accounting for them is needed. And in addition, we are not aware of guidance in other standards that would allow us to recognize premiums paid for synergies as a separate asset. Accordingly, I want to ask the committee whether they agree with this part of our analysis, and second, whether they can give examples of synergies where
they could be recognized as a separate asset under IFRS. In my paper we make reference to paragraphs 12 of IRIS 38 for the identifiability and paragraphs 163 in sequential in the basis for conclusion of IRIS 3.
Now, I guess my question, Thomas, was where you are in the paper, and I think what you're saying.
You've
taken us through paragraph 11 of your paper. Is that correct?
Yes, it's 4 to 11 in the paper. Sorry, I misunderstood that.
Andrew? Okay, I'm not getting any disagreement, Thomas. So, Laurence, excuse me, you're hard to see down there.
I agree. It's not an intangible asset of a representative of premiums. But I was wondering whether we could not search further into the intangible asset route. Because what is actually a joint venture? It's an entity entering into contractual agreement with some other parties to do some business together. So, in fact, there is a contract. Couldn't the issue be approached to say that this residual amount is the contract costs for entering into a JV? So it's the price of the contract. It's the recognition of the contract. So it's associated with the contract. So it's identifiable. It's legal right to be in this joint venture. And therefore, couldn't you say it is an intangible asset that can be recognized separately, even if it works with some other assets, and maybe it is? I think I would prefer this route rather than going to say it's a goodwill. Because goodwill, as I expressed in the previous time, goodwill, in order to recognize goodwill, you must control it. If it is an asset, it's an asset you control. You don't control the goodwill of the business as such. Whereas here, yes, you control that contract. You have entered into a contract and you have control over that contract, which is entering into GV, and this is the price for the contract.
Ruth, and then back to Andrew.
I agree with the staff's analysis. I think we agreed at the last meeting, and it's reflected in paragraph 14 through 16, that although there is a business, the business is not controlled by the venturer, which is why it's outside the scope of IFRS 3, and that was the advice we were given by the board members present. And so I think if that's the case, we can't have goodwill under IFRS 3, so we would need to identify something else. I hadn't thought of your argument, Laurence, but I'm not convinced by it. So at this point, I agree with the staff's analysis, but I will flag that because of that, I struggle to understand why you've recommended the combination approach later on in the paper, where the effect would be that you would permit an entity to recognize goodwill. I don't understand how you've got to that position, so I'll just flag that now.
Andrew again, and then over to Scott.
Well, I don't personally have too much of a problem with goodwill. I understand what Laurence says about not controlling things, but then you don't control the PP&E, you don't control anything in the joint venture, you don't control any of the other assets. So I don't see the big issue. So.
Scott?
I agree with the staff's analysis. I think this is a business, so there is goodwill in it. I don't have a problem recognizing our portion of the goodwill any more than I have a problem recognizing our portion of the PP&E and everything else. So, and I think trying to gerrymander some other intangible asset to recognize so that we can make ourselves feel better by not recognizing goodwill that we don't control is really solving a problem that doesn't exist, because we already ought to feel just as bad for recognizing the other assets we don't control.
We seem to be divided. But of those of you who said you agreed with the staff's view that this was not an intangible under 38, does that lead you to say that you would therefore not recognize anything, or it's just that you agree with this piece of the analysis, but you're ready to go ahead and think about recognizing anyway?
Agree with the analysis so far, but it has implications for the next bit.
Andrew?
I'm fine with the analysis so far. And I'm
okay. Let's keep pushing then and see how it goes.
All right. The next part is whether we get further guidance in IVRS. This is paragraphs 12 to 23 of the agenda paper. While looking for other guidance in IVRS, as one could think about paragraph 2b of IVRS 3. However, we think that paragraph 2b of IVRS 3 addresses the acquisition of a group of assets that does not constitute a business as defined in IVRS 3. In other words, the reason why such an acquisitions are not within the scope of IVRS 3 is not a lack of control. The reason why such acquisitions are not within the scope of IVRS 3 is the fact that the group of assets acquired is not a business as defined in IVRS 3. We think this is a different scenario than the one we are addressing here, where one has a business but not control. In reflection of the view that many committee members think that IVRS 3 is not applicable IVRSs to the particular assets and liabilities of, in terms of paragraph 21 of IVRS 11, we think there is no standard that gives comprehensive and consistent guidance on the accounting for the acquisition of an interest in a joint operation in circumstances where the activity of the joint operation constitutes a business as defined in IVRS 3. Accordingly, entities acquiring such an interest must develop an accounting policy that takes into consideration paragraphs 10 to 12 of IS 8. From our outreach to interested parties, we noted that three approaches have been developed. First one is the fair value, it's what we call the fair value approach in the paper. This approach is applying the guidance in IVRS 3 and the guidance related to business combinations and other standards by analogy. The cost approach, which is allocating the cost of the business combination to the identifiable assets and liabilities based on their relative fair values. Accordingly, a premium paid for synergies is allocated to the identifiable assets. And further, combination approach. Identifiable assets and liabilities are measured at fair value with few exceptions, and the residual is recognized as a separate asset that is goodwill. We understand that the basis of this approach is the cost approach, but the guidance in IVRS 3 is applied to issues that are not addressed elsewhere in IVRSs. For example, the recognition and measurement of goodwill and the allocation to other assets. These are the only approaches that we noted are applied by preparers of financial statements that do not consider IVRS 3 to be one of the IVRSs applicable to the particular assets in terms of paragraph 21 of IVRS 11. We are not aware of any other approaches that have been applied by preparers so far, but would be interested to hear from the committee members whether they have observed other approaches to be applied. And in addition, we think that all three approaches can be chosen in applying paragraphs 10 to 12 of IS 8. However, although these three approaches could be used by applying the guidance in paragraph in IS 11, the diversity in practice is not addressed. Consequently, we want to ask the committee the following questions. First of all, do the committee members agree with this part of the staff analysis? And second, did the committee members observe any other approaches that have been developed in practice?
I've got Peggy and Ruth up.
I had a question. I'm sorry. I had a question on what is the basis for the combination approach.
We understand the basis of the combination approach is a cost approach. You recognize cost by allocating it to the identifiable assets. Only the basis for allocating is not the relative fair values of the assets. It's the other assets are measured at fair value, but the residual then is allocated to goodwill.
So it's essentially drawing on different parts of IFRS to develop your policy by analogy to those different parts, but using a cost basis approach as being the sort of the basis of that.
But it's cost basis with
cost basis with goodwill.
With goodwill, yeah. Exactly. Yes,
exactly.
Yes. And saying that the cost of something, if you were to buy it individually, so separate from all the other assets that you're buying collectively, but if you bought each one individually, then the cost would be its fair value.
Ruth?
I think the first question was, do we see any other approaches in practice? I think this is an accurate description of what we do see in practice. Practice is mixed. The way I would describe the three approaches is the first approach, the fair value approach, is full analogy to IFRS 3 with capitalization, with recognition of goodwill, expensing transaction costs, recognizing deferred tax, recognizing contingencies. So that's full analogy to IFRS 3 to the extent relevant. The middle approach, the cost approach, is no analogy to IFRS 3. So the first one is all of it. The second one is none of it. And the last one, and it's the same question as Peggy, is some of it, the bits that appear. So my concern about the combination approach is the sum of it approach is it's cherry picking. It's taking bits of IFRS 3 that are seem to be, I don't know, useful, relevant, whatever, but I'm struggling to see the technical justification for it. I would be happy with all of it or none of it, and the none of it is the cost approach, but I can't understand the technical rationale for some of it, particularly where it's only the goodwill that's recognised and the rest of what IFRS 3 requires is just quietly ignored. And we did reach a conclusion a few months back on application by analogy, yeah, and whether it was appropriate to have a partial analogy to a standard. And I'm pretty sure we said, no, if you're going to analogize to a standard, you need to analogize to all the parts that are relevant. And so I am worried about this combination approach because that seems to conflict with that conclusion that we reached. But I'd be happy with either all of it or none of it.
Guido.
It's the same problem with the combination approach. Just to give you an example, I don't see why the initial recognition exemption should apply when you recognize goodwill, because then you don't have this iteration approach. So I don't want to go too much into details. Ruth has said something about that. But I was wondering, what I haven't heard so far is, when I look at IS 8, 10 to 12, what comes to mind when you're buying a part in a joint venture? I thought, why not looking, what is the standard that is closest to this situation? And it occurs to me that it's IS 28. You're acquiring a part which gives you significant influence, and 28 per of 20 tells you for the cost allocation and the whole thing, look into IFRS 3. And I think that would also not be a problem with the exception in IFRS 3 paragraph 2, where it says the formation of a joint venture is not a business combination, because the formation of an associate is not IAS 28. It's the acquisition of a significant interest. So maybe if we go through IAS 8 and then look at 28, I guess the answer would be apply that by analogy, and then you would apply the rules in IFRS 3, even though it's not a business combination, but you're acquiring a part in a company that is a business.
So you'd go the fair value approach?
Yes.
Joanna?
It's interesting the discussion that Ruth and Guido have had about paragraphs 10 to 12 of IAS 8, because I'm not convinced by their concerns, if you like, because to me I read it as Thomas and Michael described it and as they've written here, that effectively you can choose an accounting policy that meets those criteria in 10 to 12. You don't have, and you've said by analogy. I'm not convinced that it has to be by analogy per se. You don't have to say, well, I either think I'm in 3 or I'm in 28 or whatever it may be. And therefore, I was comfortable that each of these met the criteria and could be applied under IAS 8. And the fact that what we did earlier by analogy, I think was slightly different, but it may be something that we might want to just pursue in terms of, like, they applied the standard as a whole because it was by analogy, but to me that is not necessarily the 8. But anyway, I was comfortable that any of those could be applied by under IAS 8. That doesn't necessarily mean I support your conclusion at the end about combination approach, I might add. But I actually had a question or two questions about your outreach as to which one of these was the most prevalent, because you said your outreach said that there were these three ways of doing it. So which one was used most often? And then secondly, you also said by those who didn't actually think they were caught by three, which implies that an awful lot of them actually did think they were caught by three. And I'm interested in, if you like, again, how many of those were there, and is that something we specifically need to deal with, which I guess to a certain extent you have in three in your next paper, to make sure people don't think they are actually caught by three. So two questions of you, Thomas.
First of all, I understood that most apply this combination approach.
Yeah.
Yes, and second, I thought they are not caught by IFRS 3 because it's not the applicable standard, because it's not control.
But you implied, sorry, the way you said it was that there are a lot of them who did think they were caught by three.
Yes, but not the majority.
Okay. But there were still quite a lot.
Scott?
I have the same concerns as Ruth and as Joanna, I think, slightly expressed about the combination approach. It doesn't seem like the combination approach was developed by looking to IAS 8 and saying, gee, what makes the most sense? Rather, it was looking to IAS 8 and saying, gee, what can I justify? I don't like the change to IFRS 3 that makes me expense transaction costs. I'd rather not do that. But I do want to recognize goodwill, because there is goodwill and it makes sense to do so. So I'll pick and choose. I'm willing to hear a justification of the combo approach that isn't that actually explains why the parts of IFRS 3 that are being analogized to are the right parts to analogize to, but I'm not convinced at this point. So I would prefer the fair value approach, then the cost approach, then the combo approach in that order.
Okay, I think I have Andrew, Ruth, Laurence, Peggy.
Well, similar concerns about the combination approach. I think it's sort of making up a new set of rules, which seem to be a bit of a halfway house. I definitely prefer the fair value approach. So I think I didn't actually think, going back to the original debate, there was an issue here in the first place, but clearly there is, and there's diversity. But so I prefer the fair value approach. The cost approach. One potential issue with the cost approach is if you're allocating the rump, the synergies, or whatever you want to call them, across assets, you could end up overstating the value or the cost of assets and causing problems later down the track. So I prefer the fair value approach.
Ruth?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Laurence is next.
I could understand all the approaches, including the combination approach, which I could view as being a cost approach with this goodwill being recognized, similar to what I tried to express before, as this is an intangible asset linked to the contract I'm entering into. The combination approach obviously raises some issues about what do you do with the transaction costs, what do you do with contingent consideration, transaction costs, where do you put them? Do you get them to all the assets and liabilities you recognize, and so on? Same thing for contingent consideration. Well, to what does it relate? I believe the more fundamental problem we have here is that the board has never clarified to us what does it mean recognizing a portion of an asset. So we struggle because of that. That being said, fair value approach could be an easy answer. The cost approach, I don't like it too much because I think that effectively separating that element that is currently called goodwill has some sense. And I could also understand the combination approach, particularly from the deferred tax consequences. Not so much. I'm not so worried about the transaction costs, more worried about the deferred tax consequences. If you say that you are still recognizing separate assets and liabilities and it's not a business.
Thank you.
What I didn't like about the combination approach is, from a philosophical perspective, we're moving to fair value accounting, and this seems to undermine everything that all the recent trends that we've been working for. And I think from a company perspective, after there's guidance as to what happens with transaction costs, analysts and investors just discount it because they look at it as a one-timer. So it's not going to matter all that much that they're going to have to get expensed, because people will just they'll back that out when they're looking at the company's performance.
Ruth?
Picking up on Laurence's point about what are these assets and liabilities that the venturer accounts for? Is it a right to the underlying asset, or is it a part of the physical asset? And I recall Philippe, I think at the last meeting, saying the board didn't intend for the venturer to account for the right to the underlying asset, but to account for a part of the asset. I guess it's a question for Mariella, because if it is a right to, then we're talking intangible land here for everything, and I'm not sure that was the board's intent, so perhaps if Mariella could clarify for us.
the principle for recognition of assets and liabilities in the case of a joint operation is because the parties have rights to those assets and obligations for those liabilities. That's a core principle that triggers the accounting. The accounting itself is the recognition of assets based on the nature of those assets. So if it's PPE, it's PPE. So it's not, we're not going to account for rights. So we're accounting for the underlying assets. Yeah.
So we are accounting for a part of an asset effectively.
Because the rights that the parties have leads to this accounting. Yeah.
So I don't think we need to go down the path of accounting for everything as intangibles, because that would take us to another approach. I mean, just to Laurence's point, I don't think we should continue that line of thinking, because it's clear that that's not what the board intended.
I wonder, let me challenge that, Ruth. As I understand what Laurence was saying, if I paid $100 to get into this joint venture, and let's assume that 90 was the fair value of the proportionate interest in the assets, that net assets that I acquire. To put it informally, I think what Laurence was saying is the 10 is the fee, is the membership fee, the price I pay to be in the club. Above and beyond my other interests in the joint assets of the joint venture. And she would call that a separate intangible, like a membership fee paid to any other club.
I'm not arguing with that piece of it. That there is a potential argument there which we haven't explored. What I'm saying is the other 90 is not a right to something. It's not an intangible.
That's correct.
It is a half of a piece of pipe or something.
It is my proportionate interest in the asset. Yeah. Mariella, have you heard anything else in this conversation that you think we need to, anything else that we haven't thought of or that you would like to comment on?
You
were on to begin with. Don't worry.
So I just wanted to inform that this topic, this area, was not something that we re-deliberated with the board. So the project was a short-term project. We discussed the classification of the arrangements thoroughly, but we did not explore this specific area. Neither we did explore the equity, accounting for the equity method, or the tension between 613 and IS 27. So that was never brought to the board. And when I read Thomas' paper, I was happy with the approach. I think there is something there that might need to be recognized. I think this standing here, I mean, could be an intangible, or could be a goodwill, or, I mean, but I think that needs probably further analysis, and we didn't do this at this stage of the project. So, and the outreach that we did, it never came out as well in the outreach that we did throughout the project. So I have a sympathy for recognizing this trend somehow.
Alan, do you see any problems with that? Alan shaking his head no, for those of you on the radio. I'm not absolutely sure how to parse the question. Let me do it this way. Laurence has given us an idea that appears to have resonated a little bit with a couple of people about first how we think about this excess, which is not necessarily as synergies, which I, for one, have always been found difficult to think very coherently about, or as IFRS 3 goodwill, but as a membership fee, for lack of a better word. Does that help others in their thinking. Such, okay, I've got Andrew shaking his head no. Ruth had said it was worth pursuing. Joanna says no. Okay, let's set that aside then. I'm not seeing a lot of people shaking their head yes. Then we come down to, we're going to recognize this thing somehow. All three methods attempt to do that. Early on, I had put an X through the combo method because at that point, a number of people had said they just weren't persuaded by the logic. Are there any strong supporters of the combination method? Okay, then my hash marks or my mental hash marks, I don't have any on the page, between the cost and the fair value method broke down between roughly equal numbers of people who preferred one or the other or were indifferent between the two. There were several people who said I could accept either one, just not combo. So let me put it this way. How many people think that the fair value method is the superior approach? Well, we're done. I don't see any basis for continuing to consider the cost method then. So you've got your answer.
Only thing, how to proceed and develop an interpretation or...
Well, that is the next question, isn't it?
Yes. How do we... Exactly. Yes, so... Given these situations, I think I see two ways we could proceed. First, one way would be to develop an interpretation or to make an annual improvement, I think, clarifying or developing, yeah, no, it could only be an empty
No, sorry, it's a separate amendment.
Separate amendment.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Is this something that we have to kick to the board that we can't do as an amendment or as an interpretation? Scott?
I think we could do it as an interpretation because we could say it's scoped out of IFRS 3. We discussed it and we think that an approach that essentially analogizes to IFRS 3 is the right way to go, and so we could put that out as an interpretation. I think that'd be the wordy way to do it. The easier way would be to just propose that we change the scope of IFRS 3 and scope the accounting for the acquisition of your portion of a joint arrangement into IFRS 3.
Mm-hmm. Joanna, you're shaking your head no.
I am not convinced by that in terms of what the purpose of IFRS 3 is in terms of it being business combinations that you control. I think just to put it in and add it to the scope, I think is pretty dangerous because what else are you adding to the scope if you do that? So I'm not convinced, and I think we should perhaps consider if that is an option, but I'm not convinced it would work. I have to admit, I do struggle a little bit with whether we can do an interpretation because I'm not quite sure what we are interpreting because I think that although we are not all, like we all said, fair value we think is the better way to go, at the moment, under 8, I don't think anyone violently disagreed with you your three options. So our interpretation would be saying thou must do it this way, which to me is actually an amendment, not an interpretation. So, sorry, cut a long story short, I actually think that we should recommend to the board that they do an amendment, but we do the work to create it, if you like.
Ruth, and then Charlotte?
Yes, I agree with Joanna. I think we haven't discussed the proposed scope adjustment that Thomas proposed, which I agree with, because I think that then lines up IFRS 3's wording with IFRS 11. And then it says this scopes out the formation of a joint arrangement. And then for the accounting in the venturer's accounts, it's IFRS 11 that we need to look to. So I think the standard that needs to be changed is IFRS 11. And that's the amendment that we should propose to the board.
Charlotte, and then Laurence.
I think I broadly agree with what Ruth's saying. I don't think we can get there through interpretation, because I don't really think interpreting it as an analogy to IFRS 3 works. It seems a bit odd to analogize to something you're scoped out of. So I think we'd have to do it as an amendment, unless the only option I had is Guido's point earlier, whether we could analogize in some way to IAS 28 or scope it into 28. But I still think you're looking at something that is more akin to an amendment than an interpretation.
Laurence?
Just to say that, like I said, I do not believe an interpretation is the appropriate way to go, so I do believe it's a separate amendment. I was considering that perhaps it's easier to do it in IFRS 3, to say that when you acquire a share in a business, you apply IFRS 3. If we say so, is it creating other problems? At the moment, I don't see them, but I think it would be a nice amendment, short and simple, with the other one that is being proposed.
I wonder, let me suggest that we set aside what causes the most problems. I can visualize problems on either one. The board did not explore a lot of these issues when Mariella took us through IFRS 11. And so the board might say, well, amending 3 is one thing, reopening the scope of 11 when we didn't do any of the work is another. I guess I can see pitfalls on both of them. So let's set that aside and think among ourselves about the most efficient way to get this done. Laurence, then Andrew, then Bernd. Laurence is done. Andrew.
Well, I just wonder, I agree, I'm not sure interpretation is the right way of doing something. Is an alternative, I think amending IS 11, IFRS 11 is the right thing to do. I mean, can we not insert in paragraph 21 where it says a joint operator shall account for the assets, liabilities, revenues and expenses, can we not insert the word business into that paragraph? Now, I don't know whether you could do that by annual improvement or is that a step too far. Maybe that's, you know, maybe that's a separate amendment, but that seems to me the simplest way of dealing with it. I don't know whether that's AIP territory or not.
I guess the question I'm asking, and I would ask it to Alan and to Mariella, is are we backdooring a bunch of measurement guidance into 11 that the board did not want to consider when it did 11? So are we significantly expanding the guidance in 11, or do you think that would be okay?
It's a difficult question. I think I would take out the word want. I don't think the board, it's not that they didn't want to discuss it, they just didn't discuss it.
Okay.
And I agree with you, Wayne, in terms of, I think that the correct approach to take here is to work out what the right answer is. And then after we've done that, and I think that's an appropriate thing for the Interpretations Committee to do, because you've identified a practice issue, you're trying to, in a very sensible way, get and implement a solution. And then once you've worked out what the right solution is, we have to work out whether that is, whether it meets an annual improvement, we can pop it into a package. If it doesn't meet annual improvement, we do it separately, or whether interpretation is a more efficient or effective way to do it. So I'd focus on the right answer, and then we'll work out the mechanism. So
I guess I was a little farther down the line than you are, Alan. I took the sense of the committee that people think this is an amendment, not an interpretation. Then somebody said, we'll volunteer to do the work. Somebody down there in the amen corner down there said, well, but we will volunteer to do the work. The last thing we want to do is to have an experience of doing the work and then the board saying, oh, no, that wasn't a very good idea. So
no, I don't think it's beyond we just did not consider, is that right?
We did never consider this. We acknowledged that this an emptiness in the literature, but it was also empty in IS-31. So this is, if it comes, it's coming from a long time ago. And I do think like we need probably like a better and deeper analysis. However, I'm not sure whether the analysis will end up saying something very different from paragraph 21 of IFRS 11, which is you recognize your assets, liabilities, revenues, and expenses. So at the end of the day, like we are going to provide more guidance on how to get there, but the paragraph in IFRS 11 probably encaptures and encapsulates everything. But I understand that there is like an emptiness in the literature and people do not know how to do it, and there is like a divergence in practice as well.
Well, but Mary Ellen, it's not helpful to tell people to recognize something and then not tell them how to measure it. And that's the issue that we're talking about here. There's no question that they're going to recognize their assets and liabilities. The question is how they're going to measure them.
Yeah, based on the applicable IFRSs, but yeah.
It's not how that. Anyway, Bernd and then Andrew.
Well, although most people said that we shouldn't do it by means of an interpretation, I'm not 100% convinced, because obviously we have a diversity in practice here, and interpretations are meant to solve this issue of having diversity in practice. So I think we could think about doing it by means of an interpretation. On the other hand, if we just scope it into three, I think that's a very dangerous part or route, because, for example, if I look at the disclosure requirements of IFRS 3, where I can't even get hold of the disclosures for a joint venture because they just don't give me every information I have. So we couldn't just scope it in without reflecting about the consequences we might encounter there. So I think doing an interpretation and telling people that they have to analogize to IFRS 3 isn't out of the question. So I think it's really something that we should think about.
Point taken. Andrew?
And I was done, really. My suggestion was to amend paragraph 21 either by a separate amendment or an AIP.
John?
Well, having listened to all of that, I think it's a little bit a bigger project to amend the scope of IFRS 3 to bring in IFRS 3, you know, assets that are, or business acquisition that are not controlled. I'm pretty much with Bernd. I think we can solve this with an interpretation, because there's nothing that applies specifically to this fact pattern. So there's a lack of guidance. So why can't we interpret within the context of the existing literature what we believe is the right approach? And I think we can support an interpretation that says only fair value on the basis of what we already interpret, that if you go by analogy to IFRS 3, then you have to apply IFRS 3 in its entirety. So I think it would be a neat way to just, you know, through an interpretation determine that we believe that the fair value model is the right model, and you have to apply it in its entirety, not the approach.
When you say apply it in its entirety, how does that respond to Bernd's concern about disclosure? Do you trigger all of the IFRS 3 disclosures too, or do you just analogize to the recognition and measurement?
Well, I would believe that if you go to IFRS 3 and it's you take everything that is relevant.
Okay.
Whether disclosure is relevant, it's a matter of materiality. And
Sarah?
I agree with Bernd's approach as well, because in listening to our conversation today, what we really did was an interpretation for us to arrive at the conclusion that the committee agreed on, that the fair value approach was where the standards would lead you. Well, that's exactly what an interpretation is. So it seems to me that that's probably where we want to go. And I actually quite like the approach Guido took, which was beginning with, okay, IS 8, but then going to IS 28, which told you, hey, even when you are you acquire an interest and you don't have control, there may be goodwill to recognize and you should do that. And then from there, that took us to IFRS 3 that told us how to recognize the goodwill and to expense transaction costs. So I quite like that interpretive process that Guido took us through, and it seems to me that would be a way we could move. Now, it's not as slick and quick as amending the scope of either IFRS 3, which I think would be a problem, but or amending IFRS 11 to say, oh, and by the way, here's what you do with goodwill. But I think the interpretation process is exactly what we did do in our discussion today, and it seems to me that we could just recreate that via an interpretation.
Scott?
Bernd has me convinced to withdraw my earlier suggestion that we amend the scope of IFRS 3. I think that would cause problems. So I think it's between an interpretation and amending IFRS 11. I think Andrew is right. It can be done through paragraphs 20 and 21 of IFRS 11 without all that much difficulty. 20A reads, joint operator shall recognize its assets, including its share of any assets held jointly. We could just add, and including its share of goodwill, if the acquired, joint operation is a business. And then paragraph 21, we can just specify that the initial recognition is at fair value, as you would do in IFRS 3, and we can be done. So I think it's between amending IFRS 11 or doing an interpretation.
Laurence?
For those who believe that we could go the route of an interpretation, it seemed to me that a couple of you, when we discussed a different approach at the beginning, were saying that under the current literature, you could justify the cost approach. So how would we justify in an interpretation of the literature that we eliminate the cost approach? So this is why I have difficulty going for an interpretation, because people are going to say, hey, you just see one route, whereas we could see two of the routes that are absolutely justifiable.
I think, Laurence, to answer that question, I'd say that through going through the relevant due process of developing an interpretation, we'd be saying, you know, the committee and then the endorsement by the board has concluded that this is the most appropriate way to account for this interest in a joint operation.
Then that's a requirement, that's an amendment. I don't call it an interpretation of the literature.
Interpretations have the same standing and authority as an IFRS. So, yes, it is an amendment to existing requirements.
Okay, the second question I had was also, if we amend IFRS 11 in the way Scott was describing, how far would we address issues such as effectivity, transaction costs, deferred taxes, and so on? How far into detail?
Yeah, and that's something that we need to go through as part of those deliberations.
I thought, though, maybe I'm running ahead, when we said the fair value method, that implied expense transaction costs, yeah, recognized the deferred taxes, and...
Right. It'd be a matter of if we did it by way of amending IFRS 11, how would we get all that in there?
Yeah. Ruth, and then Bernd?
I have exactly the same concern as Laurence. I think if we went via an interpretation, it would be a tortuous path, because I think the cost approach is a valid interpretation currently. I think when you asked the question who preferred the fair value approach, the majority said we prefer it. That doesn't mean that we think the cost approach is not a valid interpretation. So
point
I think eight. If we went to an interpretation, it would take years to get this thing done. If we said to the board, we think the fair value approach is the most appropriate, we recommend an amendment to IFRS 11, and I think it needs to be a lot more specific than simply putting in one or two words. I think it needs to address all of the things that Laurence identified very clearly. So it probably needs its own little paragraph. And the board can then expose it, and there can be adequate due process and transition, et cetera, et cetera. I think that is a less tortuous path than trying to do an interpretation which would take another 3 years to get through.
While I agree that it would be very difficult maybe to reach a consensus and that it would take us some time, I quite strongly disagree that an interpretation is not the right means to do it when you have two valid interpretations of a standard. I think that's exactly what an interpretation is about. Because if the standard was clear from the beginning, we would never need an interpretation. It's always the case that you have two interpretations of a standard. They are both somewhat justified, and we need to draw the line where to go. It's the same case in IFRIC 10, where you have valid interpretation about interim reporting, two conflicting standard. You can go either this way or that way. And it's the same way here. Of course, you can justify the cost approach, but we have to tell people what we think is the better interpretation. So I think that's exactly what an interpretation is about. So I quite strongly disagree with Laurence and Ruth on that.
But if you continue that, wouldn't you say business combinations under common control, you could interpret that as well, because there are two valid things there. And I think their point is that normally is a fundamental decision, and because it was scoped out, well, scoping something out just means that they're worried about protecting, you know, they don't want to just force that onto people. It doesn't mean you can't do it. But I think that's what Ruth and others are saying, is that by doing this, you're making a fundamental decision as opposed to saying the words are unclear and I could read them either way. It's very clear you could go left or right and you're the same which one to choose. So it sounds more like something the board would have to basically take on board themselves based on the advice from here.
I'm not sure I would describe a non-existent as unclear. I think the words just don't exist. Scott?
Just going to support what Bernd said. I think this is appropriate for an interpretation. It might be easier to do by amendment, and if so, we ought to do it by amendment. But I don't think there's anything wrong with doing an interpretation here.
Okay. Let me propose this. We're speculating now about what's easy and what's hard, without actually having, you know, we've all got kind of a gut feel about it, but we're not, I for one am not absolutely sure. We're worried about Thomas not having enough to do anyway. So what I would propose is that for the next meeting, the staff bring back not a full draft, but an outline of what would it be entailed by an interpretation, an amendment to 3 or an amendment to 11, and a list of the pros and cons, so that we have something in front of us that we can reasonably deal with. Is that acceptable to the committee? Okay. Given that, Thomas, do we need 8B? Do we want to talk about 8B too?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. In the last committee meeting, the committee directed us to do an analysis whether the scope exception in paragraph 2A of IRIS 3 can or should be amended to exclude all formations of joint arrangements through the annual improvement process. In doing so, we have analyzed the relevance of the scope exception and concluded that it addresses the accounting in the financial statement of the joint venture itself. We called that the joint venture level in the agenda paper, in contrast to the accounting in the financial statements of the venturer, what we called the venturer's level in the agenda paper. The scope exception is needed to prevent IRIS 3 from being applied in accounting for the formation of a joint venture in the financial statements of the joint venture itself. This is the conclusion we reached on the relevance of the scope exception. Considering this relevance, we think that paragraph 2A of IRIS 3 should be amended to exclude all types of joint arrangements from the scope of IRIS 3 because we observe that financial statements on the joint venture level are typically, because of legal requirements, prepared by joint arrangements that are structured through a legal entity. And according to IFRS 11, joint arrangements structured through a separate vehicle, such as a legal entity, can either be a joint venture, if the parties have the rights to the net assets of the arrangement, or a joint operation, if the parties have rights to the assets and obligations to the liabilities relating to the arrangement. In addition, we think that even it's not structured through a separate vehicle, joint operators may prepare combined financial statements of the joint operation, which includes their parts of the business. Consequently, we think that the scope exception should be amended to exclude the formation of joint arrangements, not only of joint ventures. But in addition, it should also make clear that the scope exception addresses the accounting on the joint venture level and not the accounting on the joint venturers level. We noted that it may give rise to confusion as it's worded right now. We drafted a proposed amendment for an annual improvement, which is included in an agenda paper, in Appendix A to the agenda paper. With respect to the transition requirements, we understand that the adoption of IFRS 11 may result in some joint operations applying IFRS 3 in accounting for their formation in their financial statements. If a consequential amendment to IFRS 11 would have amended paragraph 2A of IFRS 3 to the formation of a joint arrangement, joint mentions might have applied other accounting principles on their formation. However, this is only true for formations of joint operations in one or two periods before the proposed amendment in Appendix A of this agenda paper would become effective. Consequently, we think that retrospective application would not cause undue cost and effort, and that there's no specific need to have a specific transition provision next to the one in IS 8. On that basis, we recommend that the committee should recommend to the board that the amendment proposed in Appendix A of this paper should be included in the 2011 to 2013 annual improvement cycle. And we want to ask the committee the following questions. Does the committee agree with the analysis presented in the agenda paper? Second, does the committee agree to recommend to the board that it should amend paragraph 2A of IFRS 3 to correct and clarify the scope exception through the 2011 to 2013 annual improvement cycle? Third, does the committee agree to recommend to the board that the amendment should be applied retrospectively? And fourth, does the committee agree to recommend to the board that it should adopt the text of the proposed amendment as shown in Appendix A of the agenda paper? If not, what changes should be made?
I'm getting, for those of you on the radio, I'm getting a lot of head nodding, and Joanna is reaching for the button. So
I had before, I don't disagree, but before we get there, a really dumb question.
You never ask really dumb questions.
Yes, I do. If it's not a business, we've all along said this is not a business combination, because it doesn't meet the definition of a business combination in IFRS 3. So why the hell do we need to scope it out? Because it ain't in there in the first place.
I think on the books of the venture, without a scope out, it would meet the definition.
Yeah. Okay, all right. I told you it was a dumb question.
I'm seeing head nodding. Does anyone object? Okay.
Thank you very much.